Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players, uncover their stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, stick around. You're in the right place. Are you looking to buy or sell a home in the Tampa Bay area without having to deal with pushy realtors? Then make sure you connect with West Florida Real Estate. West Florida Real Estate has helped over 300 homeowners and investors buy and sell their properties over the last 5 years. Their service is outstanding, just like back in the days when there was actually service in the service business, and you'll never have to deal with any kind of sales junk when you're working with them. For more information, email Ann with an E at westfloridarealestate.com. That's A-N-N-E at westfloridarealestate.com. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I don't know my next guest real well. We spoke briefly, but I do know a couple of things. First of all, I get a great vibe from him. He's like a super nice human being. And the second thing I know is that 2 years ago, I saw his band open up for Warren Haynes on his last solo tour down here in Tampa. It was the first time I'd heard or seen of his band, Blackberry Smoke, and I walked out of there absolutely falling in love with Charlie Starr's tones, his licks, and his versatility. He's equally adept at finger-picking, slide guitar, and cranking the shit out of an amplifier and making it sing. And but I say his tone is amazing, because it is. So here's a bit about today's guest, Charlie Starr, who's the guitarist and vocalist of Blackberry Smoke. And I'm going to actually read this in first person, as if I'm Charlie, because I thought how he wrote this was very genuine and indicative of his character, rather than me saying he grew up. I'm going to read this as if I was Charlie. Is that all right, Charlie, if I do that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, cool. I grew up in a small cotton mill town in East Alabama called Lynette. Music was everywhere around me during childhood. My mother's uncles were in a popular southern gospel group called the Suwannee River Boys. My grandmother played piano and organ at church, and my father was a bluegrass guitar player, not professionally. He bought me my first guitar, a cheap little gut string acoustic, when I was 6 years old, and taught me cowboy chords. I was fascinated with the songs he played: Bill Monroe, Flat and Scruggs, the Stanley Brothers, Hank Williams, even Johnny Cash and Roger Miller. Apparently, bluegrassers don't usually care for electric music, but a chosen few get the pass, like those guys. My mom, on the other hand, liked rock and roll: Bob Dylan, the Beatles, the Stones, and the Beach Boys. I loved it too. Tough situation to be in. I remember understanding that honky-tonk woman was just like a country song, only louder. So the Stones got a pass. What's amazing is that after I read all this, you can go back and start. Now this is in my voice. What's amazing is that after I read all this, you can go back and start listening to Charlie Starr and Blackberry Smoke and hear literally every one of these influences in their playing. For example, Charlie often plays what looks like a 335, and we'll talk about that, through an overdriven amp, but he's finger-picking the lines. So you really have a bit of everything in there to enjoy. Now back to Charlie. One day, a friend and I were riding our bikes where the older kids would bring their four-wheel drive trucks and play in the mud. There was an overturned truck there from the night before. Some cassettes and stuff had spilled out on the ground. I picked one up and wiped the mud off it, and it said, "Aerosmith Rocks." I took it home and played it, and I immediately knew I had to have an electric guitar. That was the beginning of my real obsession with the guitar and with guitar players. I'm a complete nerd when it comes to music. I wanted to know who played what on what guitar through what amplifier. I absorbed everything I could from Aerosmith to the Stones, Free, Humble Pie, Sabbath, Zeppelin, and AC/DC, to the Allman Brothers, Lynyrd Skynyrd, and the Marshall Tucker Band, and at the same time being steered by a lot of these bands into Delta Blues like Charlie Patton, Sun House, and of course, Robert Johnson. Then Piedmont guys like Blind Blake, Blind Willie McTell, and Bo Carter. Every time I hear that name, Blind Willie McTell, I think of the Government Mule song. It's such a pretty song. You know the song? Yeah. I mean, their version of that song is really great.
Right, yeah.
I played in tons of cover bands, eventually moving to Atlanta to pursue the opportunity to play original music. I met the guys who make up Blackberry Smoke in the late 90s. By that time, writing songs had become very important to me. We formed Blackberry Smoke in early 2001, and immediately made our first album and hit the road. Here it is, almost 17 years, 5 studio albums, and 1 live album later, and we're still at it. We've been around the world, played Madison Square Garden, the Hollywood Bowl, and the Ryman. We've recorded songs with Bob Weir and George Jones, and we've had 2 albums in a row debut at number 1 on the Billboard Country Albums chart, which is strange. Our fans are dedicated, and we love them dearly. My cup is full. Charlie Starr, thanks so much for your time. Welcome to the show, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Hey, first of all, congratulations on all the success you guys have experienced, and mostly congratulations on your longevity in the music industry. I think 17 years might as well be 170 years, especially with the same core unit. So that's awesome, you know. My question was, what do you think accounts for the band's ability to survive, thrive, and get along over that period of time?
The only thing that I can attribute it to is tenacity. We kind of put maybe inadvertently put a stake in the ground in the beginning. I'm not sure what or where that stake is, because we don't have like a destination, but everybody, the dedication immediately was incredible. And when I think back now, I think, well, hell, we all quit our jobs, you know, and we weren't kids. We were all in my late 20s. So, you know, and we were all having kids and, you know, I don't think any of us are married to the woman that we were married to then.
you had a practice run.
Yeah. But, and genuinely the love of the music and of playing it together.
Hmm.
Cause we've kept the same lineup. We added Brandon Steele on the keys, 7 or 8 years ago, I forget which, but, and then the initial 4 of us, you know, we started and bought a van and a crappy trailer, and that was it. You know?
Would you say, like, I've been with my wife for 25 years, which is like pretty amazing for me, I think.
Yeah.
But I would say the secret of, I don't know, secret, but one of the ways that we've kept that machine running is someone's always willing to, like, not give, but like work. And would, you know, I mean, I think you can't have any relationship unless that's, you know,
yeah,
like being right is not important.
Right.
Working this shit out is important.
Yeah, you got to have at least one person's got to be the level-headed one.
Yeah, and it varies between, you know, day or topic or disagreement or whatever. But would you say you guys have kind of had a similar approach with that?
Well, not really. I mean, we've got, of course we fight, you know, all bands do. In Britt Turner, the drummer, we've always had, he's the level head, always has seemed to be, very driven. He's a great businessman. He's a great artist, as far as our, the design work for the band. He's always been the guy that designs the visually, you know, the merchandise.
Yeah.
But when we were young, and we were all wild and crazy and we're just really just partying way too much. And he was the one that was like, whoa, get in the van, you know, is rounding us up, so to speak. So he's my best friend, you know. I mean, I've always looked to him as being like the dude I can always count on,
yeah,
you know. But I think times would get tough and his stick-to-itiveness, I think, rubbed off on everybody.
Hmm.
As far as the band, you know, this vision.
Sure.
And I don't know. I look back on it now and think, well, I could have written all these songs and not had anywhere to play them or anybody to play them with, you know. And thanks to him, I won't give him all the credit, even though I do love him, but, you know, he was the... Once people started getting sober in the band, and then that was everything sort of – that made his job easier.
Yeah, it's tough enough to round up people that aren't, like, in the throes of addiction, man. I couldn't imagine being the ringleader of a bunch of people that have substance abuse issues. That is a tough job, man.
Yeah, he. I read somewhere in an interview where he said he wanted to hire somebody back then to knock our heads together, so we'd pass out.
So he was kind of like the big brother, and everybody sort of turned, acknowledged that, and said, "Okay, let's listen to what Big Brother's saying. Let's shut up, move on, whatever."
And, yeah, in yeah. a way. I mean, there were times he and I both can be alpha dogs about a lot of things, and you know, go head to head about it, but. We always wind up seeing eye to eye. So it's a, you know, I think every band has to have, people like that, you know,
yeah,
to be like, okay, what are we doing? We're fucking wasting our time here. Yeah. We're chasing our tail. This is what we need to do. So, yeah, it makes for, I think a lot of bands will break up when they don't have that, you know?
So he's like the de facto president of the company, almost, in a sense, or the office manager is probably a better way to put it.
Not really. I mean, we defer to each other on everything, but I'm talking about in the early days, he was the one that sort of took care of the rest of us drunk idiots. but at the same time, I mean, you know, I think our machine, I mean, you know, the bands work in really weird ways. Who knows, you know, what keeps people together, but
no, totally. That's a very true statement.
But I know, I don't know. I've always felt like that, that he and I make a good team when it comes to, you know, steering the ship maybe,
awesome.
or putting things to a vote, you know, to the whole band. And, I've kind of got the music side and he's kind of got the business side. So it's a good way to work.
Good. Yeah. That's amazing. That's just such a long tenure. And by the way, everybody listening, if you've never heard Blackberry Smoke, please go and check them out. They are a tremendously talented band. All their original stuff is great. They're a ton of fun in concert and they cover a wide variety of music, anywhere from, you know, I mean, when they're not doing their own stuff, anywhere from the Allman Brothers' One Way Out to Black Sabbath, Fairies Wear Boots. So if you like rock and roll, you're going to love these guys. Charlie, in your bio, you said we formed Blackberry Smoke in early 2001 and immediately made our first album and hit the road. And I thought, man, that's really unusual to make a record so quickly. That's not the norm. And I had a few questions about that. And the first one was, what prompted you guys to do that?
Well, we came out of the demise of another band. Myself and Britt and Richard Turner, the brothers, their bass player and drummer. And we, the three of us, wanted to stay together because it felt good, you know, what we were doing together felt right. So I had written this band that we played in before. It was with another singer-songwriter, and we played his songs and he sang them, and we were just his band. Anyway, so when that band split up, I said, well, I've got some songs, want to try those out. And so we worked them up as a three piece. And, but I knew we had to have another guitar player, and harmony, vocal harmony is very important to me. And I remembered an old buddy of mine from just out of high school, Paul Jackson, who played guitar and sings really beautiful high harmony. Anyway, so I had three songs that I really was confident would work for this new band. And we went into a studio and made demos of those three songs. Nobody was excited, really. It was fun, but nobody was like, hey, this is really, really great. You know, we're just like, okay, this is pretty cool. And then our buddy Jesse Dupree from the band Jackal, he heard one of the songs and said it was his favorite song he'd ever heard.
Wow.
It was the song's on our first album. It's called Sanctified Woman. Anyway, he said, hey, I want to get you in my studio and re-record this, you know, let's make an album. And I thought, well, shit, I've only got five songs. So he said, well, you better write five more. So I did. And it was really exciting at that point because I thought that and what you're talking about, the jumping off point, that was it. It was like, oh shit, okay, well, now we have a band, you know. So wrote some more songs, picked a couple of covers. At that point, I mean, we didn't have enough, we couldn't really go play anywhere yet because we only had five songs, you know. So, and then after we started to make the record at his studio north of Atlanta. And somewhere in the middle of making the album, he said, hey, you want to come go on the road open for Jackal? And it was about a month of shows, 30 to 35 days out. And so we said, well, shit, we better get some transportation. And so we rented a cargo van and piled all our gear we took the seats out and piled all the gear in the back, and somebody would sleep on top of the gear, you know. But we had to play. We played our brand new five songs and maybe three or four covers to fill up a 30-minute opening slot.
Right.
And we have not stopped.
And
we've been on the road pretty much constantly since then.
So Jesse produced that first album.
He did, yeah.
So basically, like, it sounds like organically everything happened that was, you know, everything lined up. I mean, obviously there's a ton of hard work involved, but it's like the right doors opened up that sort of led you along, and you guys just had the courage to keep following those doors as they opened.
Yeah, at that point, I mean, I couldn't put my finger on the exact date, you know. I would say that was 2001. But that's when we all quit our jobs you know, prepared to live on bologna sandwiches and Marlboro Reds for the next couple of years. We learned how to tour. That was trial by fire. Here you go. Suck it up. This is, you know, and I think everybody was like, oh man, this is nothing like I thought it would be. There's no tour bus. There's no, you know, glamour, you know.
Yeah. So all the Cream magazine articles that you'd read somehow fell short of the actual experience.
Yeah. And there were some nights, you know, we would play, their audience then, was rough, man, in the best way. There was a rock and roll show, loud and greasy and dirty, and at that point, I mean, we fell right into that. But then there were some nights where, you know, people are like, who is this? I don't want to hear this shit. I came to see the headliner.
Right.
So we learned right away that I can't tell you how many times over the years people have asked me, what's it like to open for this person, or what's it like to open for that person? And honestly, sometimes it sucks because if you're not getting anything back, you know, but you know, that's what puts, you know, a rough hide on you, you know, it's, you're not everybody's cup of tea, and you find that out, you know, so you find the people that do like you and you play for them.
Yeah. I was going to say, you don't, I think it's probably critical if you're going to be successful that you don't take that personal, because you can't make any, it's like making everyone happy is ridiculous. It's not possible.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we learned that, you know, you have good nights and bad nights, and sometimes you win them, sometimes you don't, and you move on.
So I had a question. What do you think the short and long-term impact of this was on your confidence, your career, and your positioning? It sounds like it was fantastic because it was baptism by fire, basically.
It was. I wouldn't trade it for anything. I feel sorry for bands who don't, not feel sorry, that's a heavy way to put it, but bands who don't just jump in with both feet, you know, and buy a van and go play for, you know, a lot of the places that we were playing, not on that tour, or after that tour, rather, that's when we started playing every shithole between here and California, and sometimes playing for the bartender. I remember one time we pulled into New Mexico, Las Cruces, maybe. I forget the city. Anyway, we had a show book. I think our guarantee was $200. And we pulled up, and the club looked like it had been closed. It was like the windows were boarded up. And and we get there, and there's nobody there. It's in the early afternoon. We're going to load in. And finally, this guy pulls up, and he looks coked up and gets out of his car and is like, uh-oh. And he unlocks the door and he's like, who are you? You know, it was total like Blues Brothers.
Yeah, we're the band.
We're like, we're playing here tonight. And he's like, shit, man, I have not. I'm sorry. There's no, you know, basically there were no posters up. Nobody knew we were playing before Facebook, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so basically we set up our gear and he like runs and locks himself in his office. And the bartender and a waitress show up, two people. And that's all. And we started to play, and the bartender goes, hey, man, you guys just want to call it? You just want to get out of here? I'll give you $200. So we said, cool.
Easiest money you've ever made, sort of.
We got our cash money and the money for a burger. See you later. So, those kind of things didn't happen, luckily, all the time, but... it was no bed of roses, that's for sure.
Do you think that in recording an album, you know, in making your album and having those five songs even that you first, you kind of had like skin in the game now?
Yeah. It got real.
Yeah.
You know, immediately. It's like, okay, well, here's a record, full of original songs, you know? And, honestly, before that, I had started to write songs, but I had not been in a band, not really, that was an outlet for me as a songwriter. You know, the band that we were in previous to Blake Berry Smoke, that guy didn't want to hear from me about songs. He had his own. And anyway, it was like, okay. I remember Jesse Dupree asking me... as we were getting into that record, he's like, are you prepared to write a record every year? And I said, no. Hell, I was like, no, it took me 10 years to write these five. But, you know, and I never really thought about that again. You get into doing it and you just do it, you know?
Well, being on the road, all those experiences, they were probably very good fodder.
Yeah. Now
for you to have a whole catalog of stuff to discuss in future songs.
Yeah, it's a powerful muse, the road.
Wow. Did you guys ever have like a holy shit moment? Like, you know, you're out there and as a point in time that said, you know, you think back about that place in Las Cruces and then you look at each other and say, holy shit, I actually think this is happening now.
I think mine was the first time we sold out a show of our own.
And where was that?
I have this nagging memory that tells me it was Raleigh, but I'm not sure. I couldn't be sure, but it definitely wasn't Atlanta. We didn't start to, only our friends would come see us in Atlanta for years, so we stayed away. Actually, that sold out show might have been Michigan at the Machine Shop, the great rock and roll bar in Michigan. But anyway, seeing a line of people around the building at a club, you know, that was a holy shit moment. And it was like, whoa, they're here to see us. You know?
That felt great.
Not Lynyrd Skynyrd or Zac Brown or whoever.
You know? Right, right.
So I think that is when you know it's working, whatever you're doing. Like, okay, they paid money to hear us play our songs. This is good. It's real.
So you go into that club, how much more jacked up do you feel like to pick up your instruments and just, you know, obviously you got to go up and give 100% every night, but when you see something like that, it's got to give you like an extra, like a turbo energy charge almost.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. Nothing at all. I mean, well, I've never jumped out of an airplane, so maybe that's like it, but but that feeling when the lights go down and the people let you know they're there, that's the shit.
Awesome, man. Where did the tradition come from for you guys to perform all these cool covers?
Well, you know, in the beginning when I was telling you we didn't have enough original songs to play, let me expand on that a little bit. Those club gigs that we would play around this country, and even in Europe when we started to go to Europe, we didn't do it then, but early on, in the early days of the band, rather, we would play some clubs where we played two or three sets a night.
Wow.
And so we you know, I mean, we were a bar band, so we started playing a bunch of covers to fill up sets. And so that's where that came from, you know. And then as we put our first record out, and then our second record, and I mean, you grow and you get out of the bars and you don't have to play covers anymore. You don't have to play three sets anymore. but that we're music lovers and we love playing those songs, and so that love is still there.
Right. But now you could probably be selective and pick the songs and choose more like, hey, you know, your primary thing isn't to keep people awake. It's to, you know, enjoy the music. And you can say, hey, let's do this. We like this one. And instead of, we need to play, you know, X, Y, Z, because that's, you know, what everybody wants to hear.
Yeah, we used to play, we did it for about a year. We played the Easy Rider motorcycle rodeos and bike shows for Easy Rider magazine. They were great to us. They paid us a lot of money, and they put us up in the nicest hotels in town. It was odd, to be honest with you, because a lot of times those hotels were not sure why we were there, you know, security. But anyway, at those bike shows, we basically were background music, and we would play. I remember thinking, okay, well, we would play one of our songs, and people would just walk on by. but if we played like Flirting with Disaster, or here they would come.
You're Steppenwolf or something like that.
And they lose their shit. You know? So, it's good to not have to play Keep Your Hands to Yourself or something to make people get excited. Not that I don't love that song, because it's fantastic. But
yeah, no, I totally get it.
But Paul Jackson and I, we've been in cover bands since we were kids, you know, since we were 15, 16 years old. Mm. Sneaking into bars, you know, playing those songs. So it was not new to us. I think Britt and Richard, they had always been in original bands since their teens. They were in a couple of speed metal bands, actually.
Oh, wow.
When we would have to play covers to fill up time, Paul and I would be like, oh, man, you know, but they were like, hell yeah, let's play. They had never done it.
Yeah, the grass is always greener, you know.
Yeah,
that's funny. Just question: the guy that the band that you and Britt and Richard were in, you don't have to say his name. Whatever happened to him?
I think he moved away, moved up north. Not sure where, but he's a great guy. I haven't talked to him in years. I think Britt has, but that seems like a lifetime ago now. You know?
Did he stay in music or no? Or
I don't think so. Interesting.
Interesting. I'd like to ask you, you've played with a lot of different people, and I was curious if you can maybe share your experience in playing with these guys and maybe talk about any like non-gossipy stories, you know, fun stuff that you had, or if you picked up any information that helped you become either a better player or, you know, maybe just like something you learned from watching them. Warren Haynes.
Warren is, I don't know if you've ever met Warren, but
I'm dying to meet him.
He might be the nicest guy in the business. I don't want them to give him a bad rap, but he's extremely cool and nice, and he's a pro, you know? I mean, he doesn't talk shit about anybody. He doesn't, you know, I've never seen him act like a rock star, you know? He's just a good guy, and I mean, one of the most phenomenal guitar players, singer, songwriters ever. I don't know what I've learned from people like that, other than just watching them. You know, they've perfected their art or their craft, or they're dedicated to it wholly. You know, I think you learn that. Mm. Billy Gibbons. He's given lots of great advice. He told me once, is like, you need to get rid of those monitors on stage. People need to see your feet. They need to be able to see you from head to toe. And since you're going to do that, you need to go buy some cool looking boots.
Classic. Man, that's awesome.
But Billy's great. You know, he's like, man, we toured with ZZ Top quite a bit, and I remember him saying, he's like, I don't know why he said this, because we were sound checking, we weren't really rehearsing, but he was like, don't rehearse so much, just let it go where it's going to go, man.
Yeah. That's cool, man.
That's a cool thing to hear, though.
Yeah.
That's for lack of a better way to put it, a hero of yours.
Sure.
You know, as sure. a guitar player, as a musician, but you know, watching them too, I don't know that we learned anything from watching them, because nobody's as cool as they are. The way that they walk to the microphone is fucking cool.
Oh yeah, yeah, it is. Right. It's totally fucking cool.
You can't teach that to anybody. So I think when people have asked me that question before, we learned how to get out of the way, you know, as an opening act, yeah. like be streamlined and be fast, play a show, be efficient and get out of the way.
Yeah.
That's opener's job. Nobody gets more stressed out than the headliner's tour manager when the opener goes over 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Somebody get pissed off, that's the person that's pissed off.
Right. Interesting. You know, it's what you said about Warren. I've seen Mule like 4 or 5 times, and I actually had the very good fortune to see the Allman Brothers at the Beacon in 2011. What I am amazed at is he'll play, and they'll still play, like they can sell out anywhere, but he'll still play smaller clubs. They play a 3-hour set, and then Warren hangs out back signing autographs for 2.5 yeah. hours.
Yeah.
That's just like, talk about a guy with energy and enthusiasm for like what he is.
Yeah, he loves it, and he won't stop. You know, he does a tour with Mule, and then he does a tour on his own, and then he does a tour with his acoustic band, and then he does like the Jerry Garcia Symphonic mm-hmm. band, and I'm like, geez. Where do you find the time to do all this?
Yeah, yeah. I have a picture of like him and my son, my older son. He's 27 now, but I don't know how old he was back then. Maybe 19 or something. After a show he went to, and it was just amazing. There was a line of people, and he was so cordial to like person 350.
Yeah,
just the same as he was to person 5 of it. You know, it was just like amazing. So
he's a good one, man. I've seen some people in this business not be that way to their fans, and I've always felt like, how dare you, man? I mean, obviously people have bad days and they don't feel like talking, but just to be an asshole, that's yeah. inexcusable. It's just like you're making this music for people to spend their money on,
right,
and enjoy, and a lot of these people wind up sort of dedicating their life to you, so you know, it's just slapping them in the face to be a jerk, you know.
Well, I mean, ultimately, you're in the service business, is the bottom
yeah.
line. You know,
right.
So you got to at least pretend to provide service, you know.
Well, you know, and people are like, man, I'm an artist, you know. And it's like, you're an entertainer.
Hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, and it is art, and we are artists, but we're also entertainers. And you're right, we're in the service industry.
Yeah, yeah. Leslie West.
Oh, Leslie. He's one of my favorite people in the world.
Oh, that guy's awesome.
I mean, I can't think of another person who is just such this larger-than-life persona until I met him. And then I talked to him on the telephone, and it's just like he's like the New York version of Warren. Just a sweetheart. You know?
Well, what's funny is that Warren lives in New York, which
right,
yeah, which okay. you know he's you don't picture Warren Haynes the Southern
right.
you know as he is living in a village, which is where it's funny.
But Leslie, I can remember when I first got into when I was really getting into guitar playing, like after learn you know the initial period of time where you're learning your thing, you know, and like what you like, and obviously you emulate people first because you play what you like to hear. Mm. And Leslie's playing was huge, and I could see old photos of him playing a Les Paul Junior. It was always just a single pickup guitar. I'm like, listen to that, man, what he's able to do
yeah.
with that limited, if you will, instrument.
Yeah.
And I was drawn to that. Two people who made me want to play the Junior are Leslie West and Rick Richards from the Georgia Satellites.
Mm.
So Leslie came and sat in with us at the Beacon, and we did a jam, and then we did Mississippi Queen. And he just tore it to pieces. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I could believe it because it's Leslie West, but it was so, I was so happy because I know he's had health problems, you know, and been through a lot. And he was just so happy to be there, too. So I thought, well, don't thank me, man. Thank you. You know, coming in, and the people just loved him. And I mean, of course they did. He was just fantastic. And God bless Leslie West.
Man, it's funny you say that. When I first started this podcast, I said, man, I want to, if I can just meet and interview Leslie West. And then I got referred to him yesterday. So the ball's in motion. And I will. I'm excited about talking to him because I feel the same way. I grew up listening to his music and just an amazingly talented guy, you know.
Yeah.
Just knows how to make you feel good.
Yeah. I heard a rumor that and I don't know if this is true or not, but another one of my favorite guitar players was in a band called Atlanta Rhythm Section, Barry Bailey. And I heard a rumor that Barry Bailey was almost in Mountain before Leslie West was in Mountain.
Wow.
I thought, wow, that would have been a lot different.
Yeah, dramatic.
I don't even know if that's true, but I read that somewhere. I'm not sure where I read it, but I thought, God, how could you have Mountain without Leslie? You know, no offense to Barry, because Barry's great.
But. No, but I get you. That's he. You know, when you think of Mountain, you think of Leslie West. You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Hey, you're originally from did I pronounce right? Lynette?
Yep, Lynette.
And I looked on the map. It looks like it's just in between Montgomery and Atlanta. Population 7,000. Small little town. And it seems like
you had that many?
Huh?
Is it that many?
Yeah, that's what it said, man. Well, I'll tell you, I grew up in New York City, and in my building, just my building, we had 1,500 people.
Yeah.
And there was 35 buildings in the projects.
Right.
So that's small. But it seems like you had a really healthy childhood growing up there based on your bio and stuff.
I did. I mean, I went through the same weird shit that we all go through, you know, but I had supportive parents as far as music.
Yeah.
I think my mom really wanted me to go to college. Life would be a lot different had I done that, I'm sure. But, I don't know. In lieu of going to college, I wanted to do what my dad did, which was body and paint work. So, and he hated that because that's, you know, he broke his back doing that, you know, all of his adult life.
Sure.
Ruined his lungs, I'm sure. He's still going strong, but yeah, it's not a very healthy living.
Yeah, for sure.
But no, I had a. Had a great childhood. I remember I was talking to somebody the other day about racism in the South, you know, and it was a friend of mine from California, actually. And I said, man, I mean, obviously we all know that it exists and hate is everywhere. And it's worse now than it was when I was a kid. I don't know. But the little town that I'm from, it's not really a thing. Everybody pretty much coexists peacefully, and it's that small town way of life is a little different, I guess. Hmm. But I don't know. I don't know what made me think of that. Just maybe you're sparking old memories in my brain. But
that's good, man. That's all good.
We had it. I had a cool childhood. Nothing, you know. We were poor, but we did our thing, you know. Hmm. But I had good friends. And easy times.
In looking back, if you had to give advice to the younger Charlie Starr related to music, what advice would you have told yourself? You know, hindsight being 2020.
I don't think I would change anything. Don't waste your time driving to that club in Las Cruces because you're not going to get to play. everything has just slowly worked itself out over the years. I probably wouldn't have gotten so into partying. I think I wasted a lot of years doing that, obviously. I was just one of those people who – I'm not one of those people who can stop anything.
Are you comfortable talking about that for a couple of minutes?
Sure, yeah.
So when did you, what was your drug of choice?
Oh, I liked everything. And for me, I would not ever go looking for any type of party favor unless I was drinking. And then, you know, I don't know if you can feel where I'm coming from. And then, I mean, once you start the drinking, then you get the whatever else you're looking for. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you know, when I was in my 20s, I had fun. It was wild and crazy. And then it got where it wasn't fun anymore. And, you know, you start pissing people off and letting people down and being an asshole and being a bad person. I mean, at one point I was just like, I don't have a driver's license. I don't have car insurance. And here I am driving to the dope man's house.
Oh, you know? Yeah, yeah.
So at one point when I was getting right around 30, I thought, well, I'm going to clean up for a while, for a month. That was my first.
What prompted that? Was there a bottom, you know, quote, bottom?
Just rock bottom. Just like, I mean, when I was that way, the band sucked, you know. It was just bad. I would listen to Britt. We would be in the van, and then we'd have a recording from the night before, you know, and I'd be like, turn that off. He's like, no, you need to hear this.
Wow, that's pretty intense.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah, he was giving me a little bit of tough love, but he was no angel either. God bless him.
Yeah.
He was just better at it than me. No,
that's a funny way you put it.
But no, I basically decided one night, I was just like, okay, I suck right now. This is terrible. Life sucks right now. So I'm gonna clean up and see if that makes me feel better or makes life better. And at the end of 30 days, I actually was gonna go have a beer somewhere. And I thought, I feel so good, I can't. It's just, I feel like a different person.
Did you go to a program or?
I went to a few AA meetings.
Right.
And honestly, I didn't feel like I needed to go back. I kind of felt like, well, between me and God, we got this.
Yeah, it's an individual journey getting into it,
yeah.
And it's an individual journey getting out of it, you know, and
yeah.
Everybody's going to have their method. It's like religion, you know. Some people say, oh, you know, Baptist is, you know, and other people say Buddhism, and it's what works for you.
It'll be 12 years February 1st that I've been sober, so.
And congratulations, I've
never
man.
Thank you, man. I've never fallen off.
Wow, that's a long time. I man, that's...
Well, I'll tell you what, I've got an addictive personality, and I think I've got addicted to being sober.
That's a good addiction to swap out, though.
and it is, and stubbornness, too. I'm too stubborn to fall off the wagon. I think it's like, you know what, this is almost like a dare that I've made to
myself.
Yourself,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And wow. I can't even, you know, people around me drink and party constantly. And I never have the urge to jump in there because I know where it'll go, you know.
Do you find that? Yeah, I was talking to a buddy of mine. He's sober one time, and he said, you know, I got on a train in Manhattan and I had a drink with a woman, and I woke up on a train in Kansas City, and I had no idea how the hell that happened.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, that was his, like, you know. Do you find that your selection of who to hang out with has changed since you become sober? Like, not that you're judging people, I don't mean that, but like, you're not, you know, you want to get close to certain people and not so close to others.
Yeah. I initially kind of had to make that decision immediately. Mm. Like, I had to change my playmates, you know. And then after that, it just works itself out, you know.
Yeah.
I don't even think about it, really. You know, I just, you meet people, and I'm around fewer and fewer fuck ups, you know?
Well, you travel, yeah, the circles you travel in become smaller or just different enough that that's not an issue. I get it. I totally get
it. And I've got some old friends who I used to party with who've sobered up too. So it's.
That's great.
It makes it easier, you know? And I could see trouble coming from a mile away and I'll just get myself away.
Yeah.
You know? It's not even a thing I give a second thought anymore.
And with age, you need to make less, at least I found as I've gotten older, I need to make less excuses. I'm not a guy who got sober, but I mean, just I've gone through a lot of shit in my life. And I find that as I'm older, I have to make less excuses about what I don't want to do. You know, it's okay for me to, you know, no is, I think they say this in the program, no is a complete sentence.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you don't need to like explain or rationalize. And, you know, I always tell my wife that when she would discipline the kids, because she would have the attitude more of no and then expect them to understand. And I said, babe, it's not a negotiation.
Yeah.
They don't have to understand. No is good. You're the mom here, you know. But it's the same thing with yourself. You know, I found as I've gotten older, it's, and you're not arrogant about it, like, no, fuck you, but just no thanks, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I did have I had a guy not long ago. I won't even go into that. Yeah. It's easy at this point. I can, you know.
Good for you, man.
No problem.
That's good. I'm happy to hear that. And your music's awesome. So I'm sure that is reflective in your sobriety, is reflected in what you're putting out.
Well, I got plenty of dirty years to write about. I think I wrote them all. I don't think I've written a party song in a long time, but now I write about the hangover.
Let's talk about gear for a little bit. It seems like you're playing mostly humbuckers, mostly Gibsons, and I was curious how that came about.
Well, that's Joe Perry's fault. Joe's not a Gibson player exclusively, I saw pictures of him with that old Sunburst Les Paul. But then after that, you know, of course, Jimmy Page and Peter Green and Dwayne and Dickey and Gary Rossington. And Slash was a huge deal for people that I was. I think I was 14 when Appetite for Destruction came out.
Yeah,
and I would be willing to bet you that Slash single-handedly saved Gibson guitars at that point in 86, 87. Sold a lot of Les Pauls. But then I wound up, you know, gravitating toward the Les Paul Junior or a P90 guitars. Period. That pickup, it's got a fatter mid range thing that I just fell in love with, and I would bet that I've got more P90 guitars than anything.
Oh wow, interesting. So you play a Les Paul cutaway? I think I've seen. Is that P90 in it?
Yeah, P90.
Oh wow, I interviewed Slash's guitar player, super nice young kid named Frank Sidoras, and they do you know Frank?
Just met him once.
Yeah, he's a really nice, like, super cool young kid, you know, really has his shit together for a guy who's 29. And Gibson loves him, I'll just tell you that much. So they've repaid back, you know, all the love he's given to them. They take good care of those guys. Really good care of them. What's your go-to guitar right now, and maybe what other two guitars would you say round out your top three?
Well, I've got an old 1956 Les Paul Junior. It's black. It was painted black at some point, and it's been my main guitar since about 1992.
Wow.
Been on every Blackberry Smoke record, pretty much every show. That's the number one. It's just the most comfortable guitar I've ever owned. Behind it is a 1959 double cutaway Les Paul Junior, cherry red, and it's almost like that black one's non-identical twin. It sounds very similar, it feels very similar, so it feels like second home. And then the third one is a new Gibson Custom Shop 345, the hollow body. That guitar is just a monster. Yeah, I would say those are the top three right now.
How do you deal with the hollow body? Is there a lot of feedback on that? Or do you only play it on certain songs where you're not smashing it and cranking it? Or
there's a little bit of feedback if you stand in certain spots at full volume, but that's almost like an adventure. This one's very friendly. It has a center block. You know, it's not completely, it's a semi-hollow.
Okay, okay, great.
But still, those wings will, they will grab that frequency and give run with it. But it's fun to find that spot and use it, you know?
Yeah.
I've got an old 65 ES-330 that is completely hollow, and I can't play it on stage. It's too, it's just out of control. Not at full volume.
Yeah.
It's just, it's unusable.
You mentioned, I think you said Dickie Betts. I saw an article today, and I don't know if this is true. It says that his manager says he may go out on the road and do some tours. He's like, for his 74th birthday.
I hope so. I heard that he had not been playing in a long time. He just sort of retired, you know? And I saw an interview with him just a couple of weeks ago. And he said that. He was like, I feel like I've done enough, you know? And then I thought, no. Don't stop.
I'd love him to play. He's a fantastic player.
Absolutely.
Love hearing him. Any cool or interesting stories behind how you got any of those guitars, especially those, the old ones?
Not really how I got them. Well, I tell you what, I do have an interesting story. I was given this year, I got an email several years ago from a fan that I had never met in Michigan. And he said, hi, my name is so-and-so, and when I die, I want you to have my 1958 Les Paul Custom. And he had a picture of himself holding it in the email. And I sent an email back and said, man, that's a beautiful guitar, and what an incredible instrument. Let's hope you live to be 100.
Yeah,
you
know? Sure.
But thank you for thinking of me. I'm very honored. And that was it. And then this year, I got a response to that thread, which was 3 years old, maybe. And it said, I want to give you this guitar ASAP. And left a phone number. So I called, and he said, he was really nice. And I said, well, man, forgive me for asking, but are you okay? Why do you want to give me this guitar now? And he said, I'm not dead. I'm not dying. But he had a debilitating disease, and I still said, are you sure you want to give me that guitar? That's just such an extravagant gift, you know. And he bought it when he was 18 years old, and he insisted. He sent it to me, shipped it to me, and I've been playing it. It's beautiful, beautiful guitar.
And what is it? It's a
1958 Les Paul Custom.
Unreal.
So that's the.
Wow. You
know, it's not every day that somebody wants to let go of something like that. And so he was just a fan. He had seen a few shows, and he was a guitar player from his teens, you know, and he couldn't play anymore. So he's like, I'm tired. He goes, this is my favorite guitar, and I'm tired of seeing it gather dust, so I want you to have it.
Is it like a Burst?
No, it's black.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. What a nice story. What a flattering story.
Yeah.
That's
so
great.
I thought, man, that's if you thought that generosity and love were dead in the world.
Yeah, that's
people like that.
Is that like the black version of, you know, do you know Greg Martin? I'm sure you do, right?
Yeah.
I think Greg turned me on. Yeah. Okay, so it's like Greg's guitar except the black one.
Yes, the black custom one. They Les Paul himself in the beginning, in 1952-53, he, you know, helped design the Les Paul with a guy named Ted McCarty that worked for Gibson.
Right.
Debatable. Some people talk about who did what, but they were all gold the first year, gold tops. And then the second year or third year, somewhere in there, Les Paul said, I want a black one. I want one that looks like a tuxedo. A black one with gold hardware. So that's what a custom is. The other one is a standard. Greg has a standard Burst 58 that he got from Hank Jr.
Right.
And now I have
a custom from, 58.
From yeah, from
nice.
Nick.
You talk about good people.
Man. Yeah, Greg. Untouchable.
Salt. I mean, man, I was like, I felt like I had just had a religious pilgrimage for some reason after talking with the guy. He's just like so pure of like, he's, you know, like I wanted to come give him a hug and just like have him bless me. I'm not a religious person even. And I just felt like so this connection to this guy. He's just an amazing guy, you know, really cool guy. Ever get rid of a guitar you wish you can get back?
Yeah, I got several of those. But, you know, horse trading guitars is so much fun. You know? Buying and selling and trading. And so, yeah, I've got too many to mention.
I hear you, man. Hey, musically, are there any influences you have that people would be surprised to hear their influences of yours?
Well, I got a lot of weird stuff, a lot of old blues that some people might not even enjoy to listen to. It's, you know, some of that stuff's really guttural and weird. But I love the Beach Boys. I've always been a huge Beach Boys fan. That comes from my family's love of harmony, I think. And then, you know, I won't even say it's a guilty pleasure because the Beach Boys are fucking great.
Could talk about great harmonies. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And those songs, you know, were just perfect. So, I don't know if that'd be even all that surprising, but I mean, I listen to the Beach Boys a lot. Still, probably always will. It's it can be a go-to thing, just like the Beatles, you know? I mean, I don't think that anybody back then was bigger than the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and the Stones.
Sure.
My little boy, I got a 4-year-old actually, little boy. He loves the Beach Boys.
We have
Beach
cool.
Boys all the time. So he walks around singing Help Me Rhonda and Surfing USA. And so, yeah,
it's nice.
I met Al Jardine I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but, met him in Australia at a festival show we played, and I walked over. We were in catering, this festival, and I said, Al, I just want to shake your hand, man. I'm a huge Beach Boys fan. Thanks for your music. And he goes, Brian Wilson was playing the show, and he was there with Brian. And he said, thank Brian, man. He's the genius, you know, and it's been a ride, you know. And I wanted to grab him and go, but you sang Help Me Rhonda. Brian.
That's cool, man. You'll see as your son grows up, it's cool, and you share that in common. I share that with my older son. I have two boys. My younger one's a jock. My older one's into music. And so, you know, we've been to so many concerts together, and it's a kind of a really cool thing to do.
Yeah.
A lot of good memories made.
Absolutely.
Know? And it's nice, like on Facebook, sometimes it'll come up. I don't post a lot. I post more like these podcasts, more than anything else. But whenever we go to a concert, we always take a selfie of us sitting there. So it'll come up, you know, hey, Nick, here's me and you at the Eagles or whatever. So it's kind of, you know, you'll enjoy that, man. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Speaking of music, if I ask you to pick your top three Desert Island discs in no particular order, understanding that that might change tomorrow with three other discs, what would you say right now that music is?
Exile on Main Street, the Rolling Stones.
Oh, wow. Great song. Great, great album.
Aerosmith Rocks.
Oh, yep.
And probably the Beatles' Revolver. I'm going to have an honorable mention in there is the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East.
Yeah, have you ever checked out the re-release of that where it's the whole concert, all the songs and everything?
Yeah.
Oh, smoking, isn't it?
Fantastic.
God, amazing stuff. I can't tell you how many younger guitarists, or just guitarists in general, I guess, I've interviewed, and they said, well, I had this music teacher, and he said, if you learn the Allman Brothers Live at the Fillmore East, you'll be a good guitar player. You'll know everything about soloing.
You know, Corey Bowles, he's a guitar player for a Zac Brown fan. He's a neighbor of mine over here in Atlanta, and he's a good friend. And the second song on the first album, It's Not My Cross to Bear.
Great song.
Dwayne Allman's solo, two solos in that song, the beginning and then his first solo, and Dickie's solo right after Dwayne's in the middle of the song too. But we both agreed if you play that, you got it.
It's a great song.
Every lick in that song is completely fucking perfect.
I'm going to have to go back and now revisit this because I love that album. I love that song. You make a note here.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to recheck that out. What's something like that you've learned about yourself throughout this? Because you've been through highs and lows and you survived and prospered and you got sober and, you know, life's probably really nice now. During this adventure, what's one of the big, most important or interesting things you've learned about you?
I think we've all surprised ourselves at how hard we can go, playing so many shows a year and so much traveling. And, I don't know if that's a good thing because you could burn yourself out. But I think if I look back, I'm a little surprised that I have been able to go and go and go as much as we have, because I've never considered myself so much a go-getter, you know. Like, for example, you're talking about your wife. I'm the guy that would that's like on Sunday, that's like, can we just do nothing? Can we just fucking sit and do nothing?
Yeah.
Of course, she won't let that happen. Being the guy that sometimes wants to do nothing, I wouldn't have guessed that I would have toured and worked so hard for this. And I'm glad we did.
Do you find that because you are on the go so much? Like, I find it's hard for me to just do nothing. I'd love to, but I find that it's hard. And then when I do, it's almost like I collapse because, you know, you're either going at it 110 and then you just like go to zero. It's like almost, I can't explain it. Like I just collapse. I don't know. Like it just
keep going. I've experienced that on the road where everybody gets sick on the road. It's always going to happen. And when you're traveling in a tour bus, you're just making each other sick.
Mm.
You know, so it kind of goes around. And I've had, you know, everybody finds their way to medicate legally, you know, and illegally.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure, but you find what works for you, you know. Yeah. Like everybody's got that. When I get a cold, I do this. And I've had situations where, in being the lead singer, I really don't want to get a cold. I probably freak out about it more than anybody because it's hard to sing when you got a cold, you know, and nobody wants to cancel a show. So I've had situations, just like you say, where I've been right on the verge of being in really bad shape with cold and the flu. And somehow my adrenaline, maybe it's a subconscious thing, or maybe it is your adrenal glands or mouth, I'm not sure. But when I get to my doorstep and I know my job is done, then I fall in the fucking floor.
Yeah.
I'm like, now I'm really sick. Now it hit me. You know?
Yeah.
I was able to keep myself together until this moment. So I don't know if that's good or bad, but
no, it's good. It's discipline. It's intensity. It's, you know, commitment to your work ethic. And no, I think that's good. I mean, I'd be the same way, and I am the same way. Tell me something about yourself people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm a minister. I'm an ordained minister.
Interesting. That's cool.
But you know what? And I married our manager and his wife. But it's not that hard to do. I just took a little course online.
It's like in the old comic books they used to have.
Really, I got my little clergy card, and I've got a clergy tag that I can park in cooler places than you if I need to.
is that what prompted you to get that? Because that may not be such a bad idea, to be honest.
Right. I've never used it, but I've only ever performed one marriage ceremony, and that was his. And I guess I'm retired now.
There you go. That was your 15 minutes of fame.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool, man. Most important person in your life?
Well, that's a three-way toss-up, my wife and my two sons. So those three.
Cool. Anything keep you up at night?
Not really.
Great. What's your non-musical superpower, Charlie?
Procrastination.
That's a good one. What's the best thing that ever happened to you?
Well, I have the best wife that I could imagine. Probably marrying her. She was she watched me get sober. Well, helped. I mean, definitely was right there. Like, you need to do. You know, she wasn't trying to talk me out of it. she knew it was something. We weren't married then either. No, I mean, you know, I don't know if it's easy to put a best thing, because the band is, I mean, I don't know what I would be doing without the band also. So it's just, I got an adulthood full of best things, you know.
That's great. It's good when you hook up with someone that sees you kind of at your worst, I think, actually.
Yeah. She, you know, in the early days, I think, was like, oh, this is fun. These guys are wild. He's a wild one, you know. And then it was like, whoa, okay. I don't know if he's a wild one or a loser. He hung with me, so.
Yeah, I think that's important. And I mean, relationships are tough, man. You know, and if I know for me, like, it's easy to be in a relationship when everything's going wonderful, when everybody's happy, when money's plentiful. But when the shit hits the fan one way or another, that's the test of metal of your, for me anyway, that's what, you know, that's what I kind of admired about my wife, that, you know, she was there. And I don't get down a lot, but, you know, the few times I have, she's always been there to sort of kick my ass and get me up again, which is important.
You know? Yeah, man.
Do you have any hobbies or interests outside of music and one-off ministry deals?
I read a lot. Love movies, old movies, and my wife and I go. We're outdoorsy types. We go camping a lot. We have a little vintage camper, a little pull behind, 67 Scotty, Cerro Scotty, and love the mountains. Not beach people or mountain people.
Where do you camp up in Georgia? There in the woods.
In North Georgia and the Carolinas. Yeah, mostly North Georgia. It's easy to. Quicker to get to when you have a four-year-old with you.
Yeah, I hear that, man.
Getting to your destination is very important. No, he loves it too. We go, and it's a perfect size little deal for the three of us, and love being in those mountains.
That's great, man. It was funny growing, you know, being in Florida here for so long. I was up in Nashville last month, and I drove up there, and man, I really enjoyed something higher than 6 inches of elevation.
Yeah,
you know, it was really nice going through the mountains, and it was a real pleasure.
Yeah.
Speaking of traveling, you've been all over. Any favorite place that you've been?
Spain. We've played several shows in Spain: Madrid, Barcelona, Valencia, La Coruña. It's a magical place, man. The culture is overwhelming, and the people are so excited, and they're loud, and they're like, at a rock and roll show, they're like the rednecks of Europe.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, they're just wild. I mean, you play Germany and France, and people can be very clinical and serious, and you know, but the Spanish people, they are off the chain.
Really? So they're more like stoic in some place like Germany or England?
They can be.
Yeah.
The Spanish people are just louder. They're just more. They're full of Italians too, so it must be something about the Latin speaking.
Yeah. People. Interesting. But then
I really love London. I mean, I would say that all of my lineage comes from England, so I think I feel a little more at home there.
Sure.
Than a lot of places. Texas, love Texas.
It's funny, my wife is from the UK, and it's amazing how old everything is there. You know, like the church where she grew up in, and she's from this little town, and it was like, I don't know, built in, you know, 200 AD or something.
Yeah.
It's just phenomenal, and it's like not going anywhere anytime soon.
Right. I've been blown away by that. The first, I saw a tower in Belgium that was, I think it dated back to 1,000. I thought, well, shit, man, everything over here in the U.S. is basically still got tags on it.
And it's falling apart.
Right.
Two more questions, man. And this one's a fleeting, it changes too. Do you have any definition of happiness?
I don't. I mean, I've been happy with nothing and then happy with beautiful family and band. And, you know, I mean, I think that I don't know if anybody can define that.
I think it's fleeting. I think it changes, depends upon what's going on in your life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Last question. What's the biggest change in your personality been over the last 10 years?
Well, I think that as we get older, we get a little more soft-hearted, you know, especially with our children and just towards people. I don't think I'm as full of piss and vinegar as I once was. In some ways, I can still get a mean on with the best of them, but I think that, you know, as we get older, we slow down and
it's less appealing.
Yeah, well, I think our brain starts to process what a lot of that anger and piss and vinegar has gotten us sometimes. Mm. And it's like, wait a minute, why am I letting this bother me? This is ridiculous.
Yeah. You know?
My old man is that way. He was a tough, stern father, great father, but no nonsense. And now that he's a grandpa, there's tons of nonsense. I'm like, okay, well, being a grandpa is just a license to be soft on the youngins, you know. He's told me, you know, he's seen me reading the Riot Act to my boys, and he said, he's, you know, pulled me over to the side and said, what are you doing? Give him a break. He's a kid, you know. And I'm like, who are you?
Yeah, this from the man who did X, yeah, Y, and Z. Yeah. Yeah.
Where did my dad go? And then he laughs, and I see it now as I'm 43, you know, and I'm like, okay, life does this to you.
Yeah, if you're smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always now look at what's the path of least stress for me, and that's almost always the path I take.
Right.
I mean, I feel exactly how you feel, man. I understand every emotionally inside everything you just said, because I feel the same way. Yeah. It's like so much easier to be, and you don't feel as vulnerable being soft. Whereas, like, I know me, I felt like if I was soft, I mistaken kindness for weakness as a kid.
Yeah.
And I don't mistake that anymore.
Not long ago, I had an exchange, a road rage type thing with a traffic thing. And this dude got all upset, and there was, you know, a pulled out in front of him accidentally, and whoops, my bad. And he was furious, and like he gunned it and followed me to the next stop sign, you know, and he pulls up alongside me. I roll my window down, and before I could even say anything, he starts, you know, in on me. The younger me would have gone right back at him.
Oh, yeah.
And it was my fault, you know. But I just was like, man, I am sorry. That was my fault. My bad. I'm sorry. And I diffused him. It took a minute. Because he was still being like, you're damn right, it was your fault, you know, and all this. And I thought, well, are we going to fist fight about this? You know, I mean, if we do, you're going to win because I'm too tired.
I'm not interested.
But definitely, I mean, I was like, hey, man, you're right. You know, my fault. You are totally right. I'm sorry. And that was it. He was like, all right, see you, you know, and he takes off and. I don't know. Point being, the younger me would have been pissed off because he was screaming.
Right, you know? Right.
I would have been like, "How dare you scream at me?" And right there for a minute, I thought, you know what? I deserve that. I wasn't looking. I was looking at my damn phone. You know, my fault.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny you say that. I was in Nashville with my wife last month, as I mentioned, and we're at Acme Feed and Seed. It's like the first bar on Broadway. It's a big place. And this young kid comes in, and he's totally fucked up. And he comes over, and we're sitting at the table, my wife and I, and he comes over and leans next to my wife and starts talking to her. And he's with a buddy of his, and I said, man, your buddy's drunk, man. Just get him out of here. And he goes away. Well, so we're talking, and next thing you know, 5 minutes later, he comes over. He goes, hey, man, what the fuck is your problem? And I said, and it was funny because I just sat there. And I froze a minute because I felt the devil inside me coming up. And I said, you know, I just like froze. I didn't want that guy to come out.
Yeah.
And I just looked around and I just walked over calmly to the bouncer. And inside, meanwhile, I'm like, my heart's beating fast. And I said, hey, listen, man, this guy is just all fucked up. And can you take him? And he did. And he said, thank you very much. So it was a similar situation, and I felt so good about what I did for me, for my wife, and I'm 54. I don't need that shit. And he probably might have kicked my ass because he's half my age. But, you know, I'm thinking, man, what if that could have been my son? That could have been me 25 years ago. And I said, you know, this is not about me. This is about this kid who's had too much to drink. And
Yeah, man.
It's funny how that stuff works. Man, I can't thank you enough for your time. I want to tell everybody how to find you and where they need to go check you out. So this has been Charlie Starr with Blackberry Smoke. I can't encourage you sincerely enough to check out their music. If you like any kind of rock and roll, they're just a great band. Charlie's a master guitar player. His tone is beautiful. And I'm going to say this in the most complimentary of ways. If you took the best music out of the 70s and the best tones out of the 70s, that's what you're getting from Charlie Starr. Is that fair enough?
That's fair.
Yeah, man. Check them out. I want to give you some places to find them. First of all, go to blackberrysmoke.com. I believe, don't say it too loud, but you might see a new album out from them, hopefully in spring.
Yeah.
And blackberrysmoke.com. Check them out on Facebook, same thing, Blackberry Smoke, and on Instagram, Blackberry Smoke. Any parting words, man?
Thank you very much, man.
Oh, no, thank you. I really appreciate your time. You're awesome, man. I'm looking forward to you coming back down here, and hopefully we can go have a cup of coffee before you perform that night.
Yeah, man. We'll see you in Florida soon.
Awesome. Everybody, listen, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thank you again, Charlie, for being so open and candid and sharing you know, a lot of good parts of your life with us. I really appreciate it. And you all go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified about future episodes along with some cool stuff for guitar players. Now be nice, go play your guitar, and most important, have fun. Till next time, peace and love, no road rage. I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.